We're in the show that everybody knows. It's independent, incidental. It's the show that you and everybody knows. It's independent, incidental. Ladles and germs, welcome back to the studio. Just making sure the audio is recording. Perfect. All right. We're back in the studio, everybody, ladles and germs, and I hope you all are ready for this one, because this one's a very, very solemn, sad episode. Very sad, very solemn, very... This is the Memorial Flash. We're going over Flash Player, because I'm sure, even if you don't know it, even if you don't know what this program is, it completely formulated your childhood. This program was the thing that created everything on the internet up until 2015, give it or take. We'll get into that in a moment here, but The Death of Flash is a story of online preservation. There are so many websites, games, videos, and other media that have been lost to time when Adobe pulled the plug in 2020. You hate to see it. Thus was a day of despair for many. But rejoice in the future of restoration projects. They shall lead us to our salvation of cataloging the chronology of Flash. But we have to ask the question, what happened? Why was Flash important in the first place? Why are we mourning the loss when we don't even know what this thing is, right? I'm assuming the very, very base level. You use the internet and you use ChatGPT. That's the two things I know about you because you're a student, right? That's all I know about you. That's all I can say about you. So what is Flash? Well, it all goes back to when the internet was created back in 1993, give or take. When it was still coming up on the up and up, they had this thing called HTML that tells the browser what to display, right? It's a markup language, basically. That's what the ML stands for. It basically is the instructions that allow the program to run on the internet. And it was efficient, don't get me wrong. It allowed to display images and links, but there's no capabilities beyond this. HTML was very basic in this sense. There had to be something more to this. Enter Future Wave Software. They saw this opening in the market in 1996 and wanted to pivot towards it to show that there's much more versatility with what you can do on the internet. And created the iota of a snowflake that would spiral into the ubiquitous Flash Player that we all know today. It technically visualized vector technology. It used the visualization of vector technology. Nice save, Dominic. Really appreciate it. That allows things to be drawn to the screen rather than bitmaps. Suddenly, websites had a whole different dimension opened up to them. They could show animations. They could be more dynamic with how they presented stuff. There's different shows and different media and different websites that were able to utilize the technology and make their websites pop even that much more. Macromedia then acquired Future Software a year later because it was such a revolutionary technology, which would then be renamed to Macromedia Flash Player. And from there, the internet would latch onto it for everything. But how does this technology work? Well, it all has to do with SWIFT files, SWF files. Communicate with the hardware of your computer like an HTML file, right? It's the same concept, but it allows stuff to be drawn on the screen using vector graphics, as were mentioned. Vector graphics are an interesting concept because they take up less memory, for one thing, than bitmaps, because bitmaps are pixel visualizations of them, right? So the problem with bitmaps is that when you're representing an image that's, you know, say, for example, 1080 by 1080, fine. On a screen, it looks normal. But when you try to zoom into the image, it looks all pixelated and jumbled up. I'm sure you've experienced this before when trying to make a presentation for your grade 11 history project or whatever. You know, these things happen, and that's why you have different resolutions for different things. But the interesting thing about SWIFT and the interesting thing about Flash Player itself is that this was not a limitation. You can just use, instead of pixels, you use shapes, different shapes that allow you to create images through their design, right? instead of having to rely on resolutions and stuff like that. Swift files were the building blocks of this kind of stuff, and they use a specific modification of JavaScript and more Java technologies to run and make sure that the thing was working properly, right? So that's kind of the main backstory as to what Flash is as a concept. It goes a little bit further than that, but for now, we can just talk about that. I didn't specifically write, but I believe it was somewhere around 2004, 2005, somewhere around there. I know somewhere around the 2000s, the turn of the century, when eventually Adobe then bought Macromedia, like a gigantic shark eating a bigger fish eating a smaller fish. It was just kind of like that one pivotal moment where this new technology was being tossed around like a hot potato amongst these big, gigantic companies at the time, right? Of course, this would then further develop the gaming landscape for these kind of browser games, right? A lot of the time, these games that were developed using Swift files and specifically Flash Player were conglomerized into different websites. So you had the most ubiquitous ones, like Newgrounds, for example. Newgrounds was a gigantic, a gargantuan aggregator of all these Flash games around, I think it came up around 1998 and still held strong throughout the entire 2000s. It was like their entire culture back then. Of course, there was other ones too, like I'm sure you're familiar with Kongregate, Armor Games, other aggregates that allow these Flash games to propagate in within the internet ecosystem, right? The issue with this, though, is a lot of the time what would happen is that when a Flash game was doing extreme numbers, either on one of these conglomerate websites such as Newgrounds and stuff like that, the developer would upload their game to the website, but then you could easily, using just like reverse engineering the website, get the Swift file from the website and post it onto your own website and make bank by advertising stuff on top of the game. I'm sure you've seen this before. There's like, it's still happening very concurrently. If you go to like coolmathgames.com or like any other website that kind of advertises that kind of stuff, Cold Math Games is a bad example because they actually do more ethical practices with the people that they partner with. But there's other websites too, like none of them really come up on the top of my head. But you've seen the advertisements. They're like these, you know, it has like the scroll of like 100 different apps, like play 100 different cool games, and it just has like Temple Run 2, Subway Surfers clone, Minecraft clone, etc. Like that was still happening. That was like way before. That was still happening back in the early 2000s. That's still a hallmark of like a two decades worth of pirating games, right? So there were stand-ins, there were mediums, there like these kind of middlemen that were able to add APIs to your Swift file, to your game, to your Flash game, and advertise it on the game itself and track analytics of where the game is going, right? Which was very revolutionary at the time because it allowed the actual developers to actually still get bank even though their games were posted on different websites. So the people who were pirating your games weren't actually doing it. And in fact, it started became like a strategy where people actually wanted to get their game out and try to make as most people pirated as possible because of these different things. Of course, nowadays you could just get rid of the advertisements and other stuff like that and make sure that the people get as little as possible. But you know what, hey, it's besides the point. And we'll see why it kind of fell off a little bit later. But for now, one of the main people who were these middlemen, these kind of advertisers for these games, was Mochi Media. Mochi Media was one of the first companies that started to realize this full market potential and latched on to these more up-and-coming games that are eventually become the standalone, like, quintessential games of its time, specifically in regards to, you'll find out. Hold that thought, and ladles and germs. So the idea, obviously, to reiterate, is that they would provide onboarded devs with APIs, the people that either got a license with them or just specifically asked for one specific, they subscribe to one specific game that they released, we're allowed to add their API to the game, which then will display ads and track analytics from the websites. Mochi Media would get a little cut from the top, but then send most of the money to the game developer. That way, they also can track analytics, make sure they get paid, whoever gets paid. It's kind of like music distributing that weird way. Also, of course, you know, it's a company. There was an interesting little research period where I was trying to figure out specifically how Mochi Media influenced the gaming sphere in a specific sense, the browser gaming sphere in a specific sense. And what I found was this 300-view video where there was a market pitch for Mochi Media back in 2008. It was a little interview, like a little presentation, where they're talking about how they could, like, cycle in and they can give, like, the... It was, like, a little, like... It was so cute. Like, it had, like, a little cycle of, like, developers and then advertisers and then publishers. And it was, like, a little cute little ecosystem that kept perpetuating itself. Wow. And one of the specific quotes that stuck with me was the fact that they could obviously communicate with other of the places where you uploaded the website, so you could have leaderboards, for example. And the way to describe this feature was to make high score leaderboards make the game more sticky. And if you don't know anything about video game marketing, this was a term that was used, coined by psychoanalysts, people who worked in marketing, a conglomerate of those type of people who, instead of calling a game addicting, because that can get you into a lot of trouble, they call it sticky. It's just sticky. It just sticks on your fingers. It's a little sticky. It's a game. The game is a little bit sticky, you know? The game is like a little molasses. You don't have to suck it off your fingers before you can really get it. You know what I'm saying? It's disgusting. It's genuinely disgusting. The way they use that term is foul to me on a very, very profound level. It's so diabolical that one key change to a word could get you out of a whole spat of legal trouble, allegedly. But besides the point, it's a company. What do you expect? And one of the main games that I'll be talking about in this specific context is Ninja Kiwi, which you might be familiar with. The creators of the Balloon franchise, for example, they used Mochi Media to perpetuate their games on a bunch of different websites back in the 2010s, to distribute and collect revenue off their games. Let's quickly go, I'm not going to discuss every single Flash game that's ever been made in the history of Flash games, but I think Balloon's Tower Defense, I've talked about it last year on my other show, actually it was like a year and a half ago, Jesus, that's crazy. That is wild to me. I talked about it very briefly, about how like addicting it was and stuff like that. But now I don't really play that game anymore. For reasons that'll become very apparent very shortly. But we can talk about the history, because it was probably one of the most... This game genuinely... Balloon's Tower Defense was genuinely one of the most formative experiences in my entire childhood. If you know anything about me, in elementary school, if you knew me in grade 3, 4, 5, 6, I talked about this game nonstop as a kid. This game was like the pinnacle of all games to me. I drew fan art of the monkeys. I drew fan art of the different, like, I drew flowcharts of how you would, like, sacrifice specific towers to the sun god in order to make sure that it was the most optimal for that specific upgrade. I'm like, I used to be addicted, and now there's, like, zero record of anything that happened. I think the last memory I have that eventually made me wake up and realize, why am I so obsessed about this game? Was when I wanted to present a specific, which we'll talk about later, but there was a specific game, a specific spin-off, sort of Balloon's Tower Defense called Balloon's Monkey City, which was also a city manager, right? And I wanted to present this game to my grade 4 class, and I realized that I think something must have happened in the middle there. Either I wasn't able to log into my Ninja Kiwi account on the school computer to present it to the entire class, or something else, I forget. It besides the point, I cried. Like, I genuinely bawled when it didn't work, and I was so upset. I was like, no! It's supposed to work! I want to present the game! And I was so heartbroken. I think, like, those specific experiences are what made me who I am in a certain way.
because I don't care anymore. Like, I really, like, once I was out of it, like, once I finally came back home, I was like, why did I cry in front of my entire class? I wasn't embarrassed about it, but necessarily. Maybe for like a year or two. But then after that, I was just kind of like, why did I do that? Right? There's a few other formative experiences back then that eventually made me realize, but I guess, in a way, Balloon's Tower Defense kind of made me grow up, you know? It's the thing that allows you to experience life as a kid, but it also is the thing that makes you realize that you have to grow up in the best case of terms, you know what I'm saying? Anyway, besides the point, let's get into the quick history of Balloon's Tower Defense, one of the most iconic Flash games of this period. It's around the like mid-2000s, I'd say. And another group of two brothers, long before Cuphead's development, though. It's just a theme, I guess, like two brothers. This time is Chris and Steven. They originated from New Zealand, and they made a company in 2006 called Ninja Kiwi. I believe Chris, because he just graduated with a degree in geophysics, I think. Very useful degree. Took a minor or took a separate course on game design, right? And he wanted to use this into practice because he was really interested in getting his foot in the door into the industry. Steven, on the other hand, had more knowledge about investment and financials. So he was willing to do that side of the business and support his brother's wild fantasy. They made small games that did marginally well on the internet. On the webs, on the digital cyberspace. On the damn webs, what are you kids talking about these days? Talking about the webs, talking about the dad. What are you kids talking about? You on the cyber, are you in the cyber webs? I made a Facebook account recently, and it's hitting off pretty well. I got three followers, and one of them, it's all my family, but you know what? I like talking to them, so it's nice.
The sweetest 95-year-old man you ever know. Just that's every single sweet 95-year-old man you ever know into one.
And, you know, I just like Facebook, and I just enjoy the community there. You know, I get to. I never expected to talk to people thousands of kilometers away. I still have some family in Sweden, and it's nice to catch up with them from time to time. You know.
They made small games. That's the point I'm trying to get across right now. They made small games on the web, but in 2007, their company's success would lead the charge on the browser gaming space forever. All right? It all started with Steven's wife coming up with the idea when they went to a carnival and they saw one of those dart popping games hoisted up. She was like, "You gotta make a game about this." And he was like, "Sure." And they did, apparently. So here's the mystery, right? Balloon's Tower Defense, or Balloons in general, it started off as just a popping game, right? You had a set, it was like a screen, and you had your little monkey in the specific center of the screen, and you try to throw the darts and pop the balloons, right? It was more skill-based, it was more puzzle-based, right? You have to pop the balloons a specific way in order to clear the level, right? There's like a par total, and yeah, you have to succeed in order to clear the levels, right? The monkey is the main character in this first game, and for the life of me, I could not figure out why it was a monkey. Why is it a monkey? That's the mystery of balloons. It's the monkey. It's the monkeys. Why are they monkeys? Why must it be monkeys? It could be any other animal. Don't misconstrue me. I love monkeys. I adore them. If anyone's seen my Instagram history, I adore them. If anyone's ever received an orangutan picture or a video of whatever on Instagram, they know that I love monkeys, but why does it have to be monkeys? It could have been any other animal. Why? Who was the instigator to the monkey? Who came up with the idea that it had to be a monkey that was throwing the darts? Is it just like the idea that it's like the only idea that I could think of is that it has to do with the circus, because they were at the circus at the time. They went to a carnival, right? And they have, like, the circus there, and maybe there was, like, a monkey there, right? Maybe there was, like, a monkey, you know? It could have been the monkey there, and then Stephen's wife was like, "Oh, yeah, look, there's a cute monkey." And then he put two together and made the game, you know? It could have been that. It could have been that. I don't know. It beats me. Or it just could have been the whole random XD. Like, I don't know. It's okay if it was the form. I just need to know. I just need to know. Please.
Anyway, the whole point of the game is to pop balloons. That was the entire premise of the game, right? In the first iteration. But then once they got to the actual tower defense elements, that's when it started getting interesting, because it wasn't just one monkey on the screen anymore. The idea now is that it was an actual tower defense game where you had to fight waves of these balloons that were falling on a specific carved out track that you, the monkey owner, I assume, I don't know, the owner of the carnival, had to defend against, right? These balloons came on the screen, and you had to place these towers, these monkeys or machines or whatever, onto the screen and pop the balloons. Simple enough, right? This game, again, was my formative childhood. And I think the main thing, again, is because it's very sticky, as Mochi Media has made it very well known, right? The idea is very simple, but it gets more complicated the more towers were added in the next expansions. Additionally, the more balloon types, balloon varieties that you had to come up against are exceedingly more difficult to predict against, and it makes the game more, what's the word? I guess unpredictable is a good term, but at the same time, you can obviously predict the configurations of all the balloons. At the same time, though, this game is very hard. I didn't know how to beat these games as a kid, I'll be honest. Because here's the thing, right? The idea is that these balloons have layers, right? A red balloon just needs one pop to pop. A red balloon then turns into a blue balloon, which then gets popped, right? It gets more progressively difficult when you get green balloons on top of blue balloons, and then yellow balloons, and then after that, in the first game anyway, there was white balloons and black balloons, which were immune to specific damage types, and also spawned more balloons. They were not just one balloon in there, there was two balloons in there, which made it more difficult because it was kind of the exponential concept of most games. You see this in Balatro and all those other kind of games that kind of make the game exponentially harder as you go on, because you have exponentially increasing power sets. You have different ways you can defeat the balloons, and the more towers you have on the board, the more quote-unquote popping power you have, right? The problem is trying to configure your space, right? Trying to figure out what is the most optimal path, what is the most optimal, I guess, configuration of towers in order to get the most pops, right? Obviously, you know about the strategy with the tower, the TAC tower, which is a AoE tower which allows you to pop more balloons in an area, which you obviously want to place on places where the track, the place where the balloons are following, is doing a loop, because then the loop will be able to get all those balloons instead of just placing it on a corner where it'll only get like one or two, right? But for more advantageous, once the game obviously expands and became more popular, there was a specific article I read recently about like the evolution of the game, right? And in Balloons Tower Defense 4, they say it was like number one charts. I remember this specifically. It was number one charts on iOS, right? So much so that they couldn't call it Balloons Tower Defense 2 for mobile, because people knew it as the Balloons Tower Defense 4, right? So they just called it Balloons Tower Defense 4 because it was that popular of a franchise. Obviously, that's kind of common sense nowadays. Like, obviously, it's the same game, but just on mobile. So you just call it the Balloons Tower Defense 4 port for mobile. But at the same time, at this point in time, this was a very, very unique situation, because the app market was becoming very, very new. It was a new market, specifically for these kind of games. It was branching out in these specific space. All you had back then was just a snake, but once iOS and Android came out with more extensive hardware, you can now play these actual games that used to be on your computer screen, which we'll get to in a moment as well. I think a lot of the Balloons games as a whole kind of fall into this weird power scaling issue, right? Especially when you see the more recent games. Like, we can look at the expansion here, right? Obviously, the first game only had 8 towers, right? Very simple, right? Then, obviously, you can add other stuff. There was, like, tacks you can put down onto the map, which weren't really towers. They were just, like, extra defense you could have for, like, a single round that would temporarily help block the balloons, right? Then you had more towers than Balloons Tower Defense 3, right? Then in Balloons Tower Defense 4, there were around 16 towers, I'd have to say, maybe. Maybe 12. I'd have to double check. But, like, There was, obviously, when you had, like, boomerang monkeys, obviously a call out to Australian culture and stuff like that. Interestingly enough, it was able to get around a lot of the copyright issues of that time. Because the interesting thing is that they had a lot of references to other media, specifically Star Wars in a weird way. Because I remember, like, the final upgrade of the boomerang monkey was a Jedi. It was literally just a Jedi monkey. It was literally just him with a lightsaber being able to throw it around and popping a lot of balloons in quick succession, right? It was a literal clone. It was a literal call out to Star Wars, and somehow they did not have to pay any royalties for that, which is very interesting to me. Maybe they just didn't, maybe, you know, Lucas just didn't see it.
The monkeys? Okay, I can't do this. I'm sorry.
That kind of thing, you know. And none of his coworkers followed up on it, and they never found out that it was a boomerang monkey that turned into a Jedi monkey. Besides the point, there was another thing I had to mention. There's upgrades on these towers, right? Obviously, you can spend money not only to place the towers but also upgrade them. Which eventually also talks when I'm talking about the power scaling of Shu. When you're transferring from a Balloon Star Defense 4 to Balloon Star Defense 5, there was a lot of extra crap that was added to make it more engaging, made it more strategic. You had to actually think about it, because there wasn't just one upgrade path this time, there was two. And what I mean by that is that in the original games, you just upgrade, and then you're done, right? In the Balloon Star Defense 5, there was the additional option to go down two separate tracks in the upgrades. For example, with the original Dart Monkey, right? You could upgrade him to have a gigantic wrecking ball of destruction, or you can upgrade him to have a Super Monkey Fan Club, which is another tower that it turns all your monkeys into super monkeys, which is the tower in question. It's a super monkey. It's again another reference to Superman, which is interesting. I guess it kind of negates it because there's a big old M on the logo instead of a big old S, but you know, it's still very derivative. I'm just putting it out there. I'm not naming names already. I'm not calling them out or anything. I'm just saying it's very derivative. But besides the point, there was two different tracks, right? There's more unique ways to upgrade your towers, which I think was the perfect option. I think two upgrade paths was perfect for me. And then Balloon Star Defense 6 came out. But I think it was a bit before the death of Flash, but they already knew this was happening. They knew this was coming, which we'll get to in a moment, and decided to upgrade to an engine called Unity, which I'm sure you know. It's a very, very, very ubiquitous engine with a lot of these 3D models, which was interesting as well, because they first released, they did a test run, kind of this model with a crossover with Adventure Time, the show Adventure Time. The balloons were invading the land of Ooh, and you had to fight them, dude, and there was Finn, and you could have Finn as a tower, and there's a monkey, too. It's crazy. Man. Why am I talking like Chester Stone right now? Only, like, two people know what that means, even. There's a monkey in my bathroom, you know? He's eating a banana. It's this is how it is, you know? Besides, only two people will get that reference. Why am I talking about this? Just look up Chester Stone. Look up Chester Stone compilation. You'll have a big old cheesy grin on your face, all right? Look up the video where he's selling clocks or something. I don't know, right? Anyway, sorry to get angry at you. I didn't mean to. I'm just a little stressed nowadays. There's a lot of work on my plate, all right? So, the whole point, to illustrate my point here, is the power scaling issue kind of got a little bit out of hand. Because in the newest game, in Balloon Star Defense 6, there was three paths, right? There wasn't just two paths. There was now three paths that you could go across, right? You can upgrade one path twice, and then you can upgrade the next path up to five times. They added a fifth tier to the upgrades as well, right? Which kind of, again, caused a lot more balancing on their end, right? That's the one thing that I was kind of like, about. Because Balloon Star Defense 5, I feel like, had the perfect balance between having the amount of upgrades and amount of complexity, right? You had enough upgrades to facilitate the amount of complexity that the later levels will require in order to beat them, but you didn't have to go farther than that. However, when you add more content to a game, unfortunately, you have to keep doing balances in order to make sure that each tower is kind of utilized in their own unique ways, instead of just being like, this tower sucks, this tower's A tier, this tower's S tier, this one's F, sucks, right? they had to keep balancing the game. And it was even worse when they added paragons. This was a very cool concept to me, because I remember in Blue Star Defense 5, there's these little mini challenges they had to do, right? And there's one challenge called the Wizard Paragon, which was a fully upgraded four tier of the wizard, which was a specific tower that you could do that casts magic spells and stuff like that, right? The idea was that it would sacrifice some of your towers in order to make it sustainable, so you had to constantly place new towers down in order to make sure that it was still on the map, so to speak. And there was like a huge weight of enemies. I don't think I even beat that version, to be honest with you. But they added it as an actual tower to Balloon Tower Defense 6. They started with the Dart Tower to make the Dart Tower Paragon, which is a fusion of all the different five-tier upgrades on all different levels, right? You had to upgrade enough towers to get to five-tier each, and then you had enough Dart Monkeys to sacrifice to make the culminative... it's kind of like the fusion dance, but instead of with two people, it's like with 500 Dart Monkeys, right? That's the entire idea. You kind of fuse them together to make a more powerful tower. Extremely more powerful tower. And these things cost a hell load of money, right? I don't expect any kid to ever know about these things in the first place. Like, what kind of kid would be going out of their way to be most optimally farming all of their towers and then making the monkey... It doesn't happen, right? And the only reason they added these was to facilitate the new update they added, where they added new... what they call, I think, dread blimps or something like that. They're like the blimps, right? When you keep regressing on the... I forgot to mention this. Apologies. I'm so sorry. Obviously, you go white balloon, black balloon. Those were two on the same level. Then you have a zebra balloon, which then spawns a red, black balloon and a white balloon. Then you have rainbow balloon, which then spawns two zebra balloons. This is what I'm talking about with the scaling, right? Ceramic balloon, which then takes 10 hits to spawn two rainbow balloons. Then you had a blimp, like a huge ass blimp. That's like literally the, it's a Moab. It's a Moab. It was like an acronym for something, LOL at random XD back at the, in the day, right? But these things took a lot of hits to beat and were extremely hard to beat back in the day, but then eventually became kind of more obsolete because then they added more and more blimps to the game, right? They added in the new, I think in Balloon Star Defense 4, they added the BFB. Then in Balloon Star Defense 5, they added the ZOMG. I love 2004, man. 2014 was the GOAT. ZOMGs. And then in Balloon Star Defense 6, they added both DDTs, which were a kind of pulled from Balloon Star Defense, Balloons Monkey City, sorry, that's where it reoccurred. And also Balloon Star Defense 5, which was the ZOMGs, which what are they called again? Like, they were like the big balloons. I forget they're called. They're like pink, and they had like, they were like, huge and took a ton of hits. Besides the point, right? That's what I'm talking again with the scaling. It was way too big for its britches. And then they added extra boss balloons that took even more hits. Like, that were more progressively harder as the waves went on. Which was an interesting concept, but it was the only reason why they added these Paragon Towers. And they're still adding more of them. I'm flabbergasted to me. Because it kind of was like, oh, cool, man. Oh, there's like a Spike Tower Paragon, and now there's a... And some of the towers didn't even have like the same abilities as the... They had before, excuse me, sorry. It's just forcing all the pressure out of my lungs here, right? Besides the point, I think in the main concept, I think Balloon Star Defense was one of the most popular games. But then it kind of became bloated, especially with the new updates, and especially with the new features they added. Like, they added, like, there's a Mr. Beast promotion, and there's like a She-Ra promotion as well, which is cool, but like, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in paying $15 for a cool She-Ra skin. I'm sorry. It's not happening. It's not happening. I don't know. Again, same thing with Mochi Media, if you remember that from like 15 minutes ago, right? Mochi Media, again, I feel like the main reason why they just kind of gave up was because they fell behind the times, right? And I think Balloon Star Defense 6 is an example of them not falling behind the times, but also kind of becoming a little out of touch with their fan base. I feel like, on the one hand, it's really cool because they added the cool updates like map making and stuff like that, which was stuff like people were begging for generations of this game being released. But at the same time, it just feels kind of out of touch nowadays, you know? Especially because recently, back in 2021, Ninja Kiwi then sold their company, were acquired by an esports team. An esports company. I don't understand it, really. It didn't really make sense to me until I looked at the price, and it was $30 million. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. $300 million, sorry. $300 million. Around the same price as Club Penguin, which was interesting to see as well. Except Club Penguin was back in 2009, which was, to be fair, a little bit less inflated at the time. So, you know, it could have been a little bit more, could have been a little less, who knows. Keep in mind as well that this is just one of the many, many different successes in this space. I look at Balloons because it was one of the most, it formulated my life the most, right? I remember specifically, like, sitting when I was, like, I don't know, maybe six, and I was watching all these cool YouTubers, like, cover all these different, different, like, ways to play the game, and I was like, whoa! And there was this one compilation where it was, where it had, like, the, I got a feeling, ooh, in the background, when I was, I was like, this is the first time I listened to that song ever. It was when I was watching a Balloons Tower Defense 4 time-lapse of them beating level 100, I think, or something like that, right? It was like, it was so formative to me as a kid, right? But this was just one of the many different games that existed back then. Besides the point, nothing gold can stay, and Mochi Media, unfortunately, either just dissolved itself or went bankrupt. I couldn't really tell from the post that they released at the very last minute. But if you go to the website, all you see is their logo, which is interesting to me. I don't know. That was a recent change, too. Before, it was just not bot domain, but now they just have that logo up, which is interesting. I don't know if it means anything, per se. It's probably been up there for maybe a year or two, but it's something. It's like a virtual tombstone, almost. It's more kudos than even Flash got, which we'll get to in a moment, which is right now. The golden era of video games could not last forever, at least not in the same freedoms it provided to its users beforehand. Macromedia was a very, very staunch defender and propagator of this technology, which was then bought by Adobe, which was a little bit more of a corrupt company. Somewhere around, I think, 2009, I'd like to say, maybe 2005. Let me just fact check that, just in case there's like 100,000 people that are saying, no, dude! When did Macromedia get acquired by Flash? Yeah, get acquired by, Adobe. Yeah, you're shooting real research on the fly. I was 4 months old when this happened. It was December 3rd, 2005. Okay, 6 months old, maybe. Yeah, 6 months old. That's crazy to me. So much history happened during this time. It was bought for approximately $3.4 billion. $1 billion. This piece of technology was bought for... Macromedia as a whole was bought for $3.4 billion. Because, again, it was like the quintessential thing on the internet now, right? This stuff was everywhere. You couldn't get away from it. And the issue that a lot of people had was that you had to have Flash Player to play these things, right? You had to have Flash Player in order to access the internet in this very specific way. And there's no other way to get across this. There's no other way to backtrack or sidestep this. There was no other company that was also selling Flash, because Flash was free and it was only owned by Adobe. So in a lot of cases, especially in Steve Jobs, ironically, brought this up when releasing the first Apple products. He hated Flash with a burning passion. He hated Adobe especially. So much so, he made an open letter discovering why Flash Tape Player is terrible. One of the points, of course, was that Adobe owned all of Flash Player, which then controlled a very large majority of the internet. He separated Flash from its products, since YouTube and a bunch of other websites had created app alternatives and didn't need Flash for these kind of websites. This was the start, not necessarily the end, but the start of the downfall of Flash. To talk about another key issue with Flash Player, would be talking about the people who used it, the people who made animations and made video games with it. There was one of the first podcasts I remember listening to religiously as a kid was called Sleepycast. It was a group of animators, Flash animators, on Newgrounds who made extremely popular animations and who either fell off in the coming years due to a drug overdose and other things, or rose beyond and became super popular. Smiling Friends is a very good example of this. It was created by Zach Hadle, aka Psychic Pebbles, and in collaboration with Michael Cusack. Both of those made this show that's been very, very well received nowadays. And it's been kind of like the passion project for the past couple of years. You can watch it on, what's it called? Adult Swim, if you want to, of course. Just suggesting. And if you don't, too bad. It's up to you, really. I mean, if you want to, really. Allegedly, you can find some other sources. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But I won't give you any links. Yeah, I'm just imagining, like, the edits where, like, I'm not going to give you any links, you guys. And it's just, like, every single link of every single pirate website. Damn. Anyway. I recommend that you do not watch this podcast now. Because it is aged extremely poorly. That is, it's a trove of very useful information, hilarious moments, insights to the industry of animation for Flash and video games as a whole. But this was the early 2010s. Of course they said the N-word nonchalantly. Of course they said gamer words nonchalantly. They were edgy, okay? It's the same thing. I'm sure you watched Filthy Frank as a kid. These things are like, you know, a dime a dozen. Like, these people obviously, like, obviously I had a very, very conservative mindset. Not conservative in the sense of, like, it's blaspheming God or something like that, but, like, more so the idea of, what am I trying to get at here? Point is, I wasn't an edgy kid, but I still watched this show because it was funny to me, right? I would never use this humor outside of watching this show, but it kind of formulated what I found funny in the coming years. And besides this, Newgrounds itself could be its own episode. I won't talk about it because Pandora's box is a very fickle mistress to ascertain. She's very mysterious and works in very mysterious ways. But in these episodes, you can see the progression of how little maintenance Adobe's products got. Constant project crashes, bugs, exporting issues. Swift files sometimes, and still don't to the modern day, open properly, even with different emulators, which we'll get to in a moment. It was their livelihoods that depended on being able to use the tools properly, because they were just indie developers and indie animators. Like, they didn't really have a way to advertise their stuff. And it just wasn't worth it. A lot of animators moved to other programs that were more stable, like Toon Boom. Some developers, as was mentioned before, started learning Unity instead. It wasn't even because of Adobe's screw-ups that caused this. I guess it was. What am I talking about? Yes, it was. It was completely cause of that. Adobe was still popular, don't get me wrong, but it was becoming more of a hollow software. It was becoming more archaic. It was becoming more legacy, right? And you don't want that as a company, do you? Adobe realized this, and they started kind of distancing themselves from the product. Updates became more and less frequent, and when they did happen, a bunch of more bug fixes needed to be happening in the process, and those bug fixes wouldn't happen in a long time. And the final nail in the coffin happened before no one even knew what was happening. Around the time Steve Jobs flamed Adobe for being closed in and having this iron grip on the internet, a new replacement was being created in 2008. A council known as the World Wide Web Consortium supposedly wanted to make the web more open, taking the power that was wielded by Adobe and spreading it out amongst the people instead, making it in-browser instead of just a proprietary software you had to download on your computer, right? Not one company was issued with this anymore. It was a global thing that it wasn't just a software. It was an actual language now. Again, like with the original HTML, which is why it was called HTML5. It was created around 2008 and released in 2014 officially, which truly began the beginning of the end. Adobe shut down Flash Player in 2020, and the internet sighed. A moment of silence, please. Imagine that, but on a kazoo. Anyway, preserving the past is a very fickle concept because the internet is so vast that it's almost near damn impossible. There's like at least one zettabyte of information on the internet, which is like a more than a billion gigs, more than a trillion gigabytes of information on the internet. Right? This stuff is dense. If you printed every single page of the internet onto paper, you'd probably reach the moon and back. I'm just saying, it's dense. It's extremely dense. Which is why it's almost near impossible to make sure, to predict, to understand how we go about preserving these technologies, right? Balloon Star Defense obviously became extremely popular, and they recently uploaded a archive of all their games. Of course, you need to download Flash Player in order to play them, but they're still playable, and you're allowed to simply play these games now without having to worry about having to open up the browser or download the Swift file and figure out a way to do it, right? There's obviously different emulators that allow you to play these Swift files, like Ruffle, for example, that became popular in recent days. But they still cause issues, and they are never fixable, because unfortunately, a lot of programs are made with multiple Swift files, and if one Swift file is missing, your program's done. There's no coming back from it. There's that media is now lost media. There's complete websites that have been shut down and have never been recovered. There's probably like a bunch of, you know, Teletoon games that I've played back in the day that I can never play again because they just don't exist anymore, right? Archiving games is not just important for the people who play them, obviously, because I'm a big consumer of these games and I love these games and I love the kind of sort of nostalgic childhood that they provide me. But like at the same time, this is more so just the idea of making sure that the information is out here and making sure that we learn from mistakes of what caused Adobe to ditch this software altogether in the first place, right? It wasn't just one specific instance where like the company got bankrupt or they just didn't want to support it anymore. This was a consistent amount of errors on their part through not supporting the software properly, making their software not open source, and having a bunch of backlash from the people who were actually influential at the time and not catching up with the times, right? There's probably a bunch of different ways that Adobe could have kept the software running, right? But they didn't want to because they were caring more about money and more about their company than they cared about preserving the internet, right? I don't necessarily blame the consortium for this kind of stuff. This was just going to be naturally occurring in itself. The ecosystem of the internet was just going to override this stuff anyway. It was on Adobe's responsibility to make sure that these games were preserved in a way that allowed you to still be able to play them. Perhaps having like a static launcher, for example, that allowed you to upload these web files, or saying, hey, we're gonna shut down these things in a couple of years, you know? Obviously, they mentioned it like a year ago, right? I remember specifically when the pop-ups started happening. But even though there was a lot of games that were saved and salvaged and put onto other emulators and archive programs, such as Flashpoint, for example, there's a bunch of other ones that just never saw the light of day anymore. And even if you go to the original, like, if you go to the Wayback Machine, these websites don't work anymore. Because obviously, Flash Player, you probably don't even have Flash Player anymore. So, how do you play these games when they're almost impossible to recover at this point, you know? And that's the interesting thing. I think a lot of the games nowadays require some sort of fail-safe, right? Keep in mind when you're making games and you're releasing these games is that digital mediums are very fickle. Even in the sense of like the Fortnite skins that you buy nowadays, right? Even in that kind of context, you don't own those things. Those things were never given to you. They're just ones and zeros on the screen. If a solar flare came onto Earth right now and completely wiped out the internet as a whole, strange, I know, but bear with me. If that happened recently, then what would happen to your games? What would happen to the things that you thought you owned? It wouldn't exist anymore, you know? Preserving these games is very important, but how do you do that with a digital medium that's already fickle to begin with? I think we have to make sure that we have different mechanisms to store these things, right? Find fail-safes to make sure that these, at least the most important information, is stored somewhere. To make sure that people know about the history of the internet. Anywho, I'll leave you to it. Let me know if there's any cool games that you played as a kid, either on, you know, say, cool math games. There's a bunch of stuff I didn't cover. I think we also kind of covered this with Torquato as well, but you know, besides the point. I hope you enjoyed the eulogy. Say your farewells. I don't know, kiss the body if you want to, if you're weird like that. Some people do that, I don't know. Whatever floats your boat. If you knew Flash well enough, you can do it, but I'm not going to call you out or anything, but I'm going to give you a weird look before you do it, okay? Besides the point. I hope everyone has a fantastic day, night, and week. I can't really say that you have any exams this time because most of you are gone. Most of you are leaving. Most of you are not even in school right now. I hope you're working, though. Hope you're doing a good job at your job, buddy. You better be focusing on your job unless you were operating a forklift, unless you're just listening to this right now. Instead, if that's the case, then good on you. Also, quick updates. All the episodes got released, finally, from last year. All right. All the episodes, every single episode from episode 0 to episode 20 have been released on Laurier's radio show, Independent Incidentals. Well, Radio Laurier's radio show, Independent Incidentals. Sorry, I don't want to get them confused. But you can go watch all those episodes now. So sink your teeth in. Make sure you watch the interviews. Those are fun ones. I love those ones. Those ones were very insightful. Watch the Turkana one. Watch the Alpha Something one. They both have extremely good insights into the game industry, especially as up-and-coming game developers. Also, quick update about Venva's company. They're making a new game. So keep an eye out for that as well. There's a bunch of new stuff as well, too. I kind of want to cover those as well, but unfortunately, we're running out of time. I kind of went over 10 minutes, but besides the point, we were having technical issues before. So, watch the episodes, and I'll catch you next week. Bye-bye.